You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
He's the highest paid player in the game, and he's been called the game's greatest living player. But Yankee third baseman Alex Rodriguez has been no stranger to scandal. In her new book, Selena Roberts, the Sports Illustrated reporter who first broke the story that Rodriguez had taken steroids while playing for the Texas Rangers, explores the different facets of A-Rod. It's called A-Rod, The Many Lives of Alex Rodriguez, published by Harper, and I'm pleased to welcome Selena Roberts to our show today. Hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you today. How are you doing?
I'm okay. You must be thrilled that you have the most talked about book in the sports world right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I knew getting into this project that here we had a very compelling but very polarizing figure. So I think it's the passion about him and the passion about anybody who writes about him is going to run pretty high. So the intensity level has been good, and I actually understand it.
Didn't this begin with you and David Epstein looking into his personal life? How did it become a story about steroids?
Yeah, you know, David and I took on an assignment from Sports Illustrated last year, about this time last year, where we were looking into what was a pretty tumultuous year for him last year. Certainly, he had a bit of a jackknife in personality, going from the family man to Madonna's man, and how that played out and those dynamics in the clubhouse. But as we went along through this project and went through the summer, we started hearing rumblings about steroids. Now, you hear a lot of things about players, but when does the rumor become reality? That was the issue for us. So as we continued on with the project, kept talking to more people, kept sort of digging through the weeds a little bit and trying to verify, making sure that we talked to people who would know, making sure that we talked to people who were consistent with their stories, who had, you know, access to the things that would make it true. I mean, those were the people we talked to. And what happened was as much a shock to me, I think, as to anybody else, is we were able to verify that, yes, indeed, he had taken steroids as a Ranger.
You used to write for the New York Times, but you say that none of this was talked about by the reporters or the players when you were working that beat?
You know, I think you hear this sort of umbrella issue of steroids a lot. And certainly we had Jose Canseco coming out a year ago and saying that he had hooked Alex up with a steroid dealer. I actually found that steroid dealer that he was talking about, this guy that he had named with the pseudonym Max. And I talked to Max about it. He denied that he was a hookup with Alex. So, yeah, I think with every player there's a suspicion about them. But I think with Alex, even some of his critics over the years, like a Curt Schilling, said he was the real deal. So you kept hearing that he was for real, that he was that guy that was too good to be true, yet he was true and he was very authentic. Now, certainly Alex had issues with authenticity in the clubhouse. Guys found him to be a little bit phony or disingenuous, but his statistics had never been impugned before. He was a guy who put up the numbers, and everybody thought he was going to be the feel-good savior for the game. He was called it over and over again. Barry Bonds was going to be the surly guy that took the place of the home run leaders, but here was going to be Alex coming along kind of on a white horse in a way and being a guy that you may not like all the time, but is somebody that was authentic in at least the statistics. And that, I think, was the biggest surprise to me, is that not only would we find out that this was not true, but we found it so emphatically with the steroid test.
He's been criticized for not being a team player like Derek Jeter. Has he always been so high maintenance? Was he unpopular when he played for the Seattle Mariners as well as the Texas Rangers?
You know, one of the fascinating things I found about Alex is the repercussions and the ripple effect of what happened when he was 10 years old and his father left the family. He felt very abandoned. I mean, here was a kid who at night would go into his mom's room and sleep in the spot where his dad was because he just wanted to be close. He just wanted to have some feeling of a father in his life. So that was a huge repercussion about the insecurity. It was a big foundation for those insecurities. And I think Alex always felt, hey, I don't want anyone to ever leave me again. This is borne out in all the interviews I did with family members and friends of his, that he just never wanted anyone to leave. And I think when you're that needy and you want somebody to like you so much and you want to exceed so much, for Alex, it became about the exaggeration. He was always great enough. He was always a good enough player. But he wanted that great story to be a bit of a tall tale, so he kept exaggerating. I think that's how he fell into the steroid culture. That's how he fell into making stories better than they were. I mean, he talks about as a kid wanting to play with just a wood bat in high school because he was preparing himself for the major leagues. And yet every time you look back at the photos, he's got an aluminum bat in his hand. It's an aluminum bat that's talked about in the stories. So he was always great. He just wanted to stretch the truth, and I think he wanted to do that to please. And it goes to the neediness you just talked about and the need to always be number one and to always be validated. And I think that is what's caused him so much trouble in the clubhouse. And because Jeter is the opposite. Jeter is, as Giambi says in the book, Jeets knows who he is, and Alex is still searching. And I think that's a big difference between the two guys.
Was that known throughout the baseball world? How does that fit in with when the Mets decided not to pursue him? As a Mets fan, I was very disappointed at the mm-hmm. time. But did the Mets management know something that they weren't revealing?
I think they knew this. They knew that they had had a superstar. And Steve Phillips is very clear about this in the book. They had had a superstar in Mike Piazza, who was not needy, who would just come to the ballpark. He'd bring his dad or he'd bring his family, and he'd say, hey, can I have two tickets for my dad, and da-da-da-da-da, and that was it. That was it for the high maintenance of Mike Piazza. That's what they were used to. Alex came to them with these demands. He wanted to have more billboards in the city than Derek Jeter. He wanted to have a publicist on staff with an office at the stadium. He wanted to have, you know, all these perks that would really separate him from the clubhouse, and that's why I think Steve Phillips came out, as you'll remember, and says, we don't want a 24-plus-1 clubhouse. That's what they were feeling with him, and I think they'd done a little bit of homework and looked in Seattle and realized that they were getting a bit of a prima donna in Alex, a needy guy, and I think that they were actually a little bit clairvoyant. Steve Phillips saw something that he didn't want in his clubhouse.
My guest is Selena Roberts, who has written A-Rod, The Many Lives of Alex Rodriguez, which is published by Harper. In February, you broke the story that he had used steroids while playing for the Texas Rangers and during his American League MVP season in 2003. Do we know how long in all he did use steroids? He admitted in an ESPN interview that it was during the 2001, 2002, and 2003 seasons.
Right. I think a lot of people also remember that press conference he gave because the Peter Gammons interview did not sound, the one of ESPN, did not sound as if he was really coming clean. He kind of blamed it on, well, I was taking stuff that might be banned now from GNC. Well, he gets to the press conference a few days later and he looks at everybody and says, listen, I was taking this thing called Boli. Yeah, it was a steroid. I was taking it during 01, 02, 03. I got it from my cousin who would get it from the DR, that kind of stuff, and he called it amateur hour, and a lot of that just didn't wash with people. I knew better, and I think actually Major League Baseball knows better because they interviewed Alex, and they said, what was the extent of your use? How long did you use it? What was going on? Who did you get it from? Alex told them a story, and he told them the tale of his use, and they didn't buy it. Basically, Major League Baseball turned around and started investigating Alex and saying, you know what, we don't believe it either. So this was long before my book came out, where they felt like he'd been inconsistent. They felt like he'd not been truthful as well.
Didn't he first tie it to recovery from a neck injury?
Well, you know, that was going to be his story. It's an interesting point. In the epilogue, I talk about how his first reaction was to blame it on a doctor. He wanted to blame it on a doctor because he'd had a neck injury in 03. And, you know, maybe I took something for that that turned out to be a positive. But I think what he realized is so many people in that clubhouse had certainly known of his use. So many people knew that he was associated with Angel Presinal, who was a trainer from the Dominican, who was caught in 2001 with steroids in a bag for Juan Gonzalez, who was known to administer steroids to high elite athletes. So I think that he felt like at the last minute, you know what? I better say 01, 02, 03, and I better say a little bit more about what I was taking, because the doctor's excuse is just not going to work, because too many people knew what he was doing back then.
What did he say to you when you confronted him in the weight room at the University of Miami?
Well, you know, as a reporter, you have a very bizarre feeling when you go into something like that. I knew the information I had. He certainly did not know why I was going there to talk to him. He's lifting weights in the back of the weight room at the University of Miami. Not very many people in there. So when he sees me, and he'd known me certainly from covering the Yankees when I was with the New York Times and being in the clubhouse a few times. So he knew me, and we'd actually had a long conversation in September. So when I'm approaching him, I think he believes that I'm going to ask him something about the news of the day, which was either Madonna-related or about Joe Torre's book that had just come out, those kind of things. He was pretty stunned when I said, listen, Alex, I need to ask you something important. It's about your use of anabolic steroids in a positive test from 2003. And he was really stunned. It's very rare that Alex is at a loss for words, but he really had to take in that moment and think about what he was going to say. And what he said to me and what we've written many times is, go talk to the union. Basically, he was instructing me to go talk to somebody else about it, that he wasn't going to say anything more about it. So I think he was pretty stunned, but as stunned as he was, at least I think he was, and he probably should have been, you know, a few hours later, he's going to a Details magazine shoot, and he's wearing a muscle shirt and staring himself in the mirror in these photos and kissing himself. So I'm not sure there was that connection to how big this was going to be for him and how it would change a lot of things about him and change his life in many ways. So I'm not sure that connection was there. He certainly was stunned when I saw him. He wasn't disrespectful. He was stunned. But I think that he really did not realize the repercussions of that moment as much as he obviously does now.
Well, Major League Baseball didn't really ban steroids until 2003. Isn't that true? So A lot of players could have used it without thinking that there'd be any repercussions. And Scott Boras, his agent, said yesterday that the game is always changing. The Hall of Fame is going to have to take steroid use by a generation of players into consideration when it's deciding which ones deserve to come into the Hall of Fame.
Well, I think the consideration has already begun. I think that Mark McGwire is going to be one of those first casualties of guys who may have gotten in if nobody had discovered the steroid use or if it hadn't been so prevalent and hadn't been attached to him. I think that Rafael Palmeiro is going to have that moment as well. I think that you're going to look at an entire era who may not get in now because of it. I don't think it's something where people are just going to adjust their thinking like Scott is suggesting and say, oh, you got to take that in like you would a spitball pitcher or something like that. I think people really feel like this was an artificial bubble that was created by the steroid era. Certainly Alex was the prized possession of that artificial bubble. And that when you have something like that, it really does rain down on everybody. So I think that there are going to be a generation of players who just won't get in.
Well, he became, at the age of 32 in 2007, the youngest player to hit 500 home runs. And do you think that your book will ensure that there'll be an asterisk next to every record of his from now on?
You know, I think he has ensured that there'll be an asterisk because of what he has done. He knows, and he has said this, he's admitted to his steroid use. Granted, he's only admitting to a 3-year window of it at this point. As I said, Major League Baseball is investigating the veracity of that. But I think he is his own problem as far as getting in the Hall of Fame. The tragedy of it is, though, he was always great enough. He just didn't need it. He would have been a player similar to what people say about Barry Bonds. He had the tools, he had the skills, he had enough power. He really did not need the embellishment to get in. I think he felt like he was part of a steroid culture and that everybody's doing it. And if I want to compete, if I still want to be number one, as we know, number one is very important to Alex, that he had to keep doing it, that he had to keep pushing the envelope. And I think he's going to have to be the one who lives with what he's done, not really so much from a book, but from what he's done for himself.
Now we have Manny Ramirez, who's been suspended for 50 games for violating the drug policy for using performance-enhancing drugs. He was caught using steroids. And his agent is also Scott Boras. I don't know if there's any connection there.
Well, I know that Scott Boras has distanced himself many times from the steroid conversation. What we know about Scott, and this is just the facts of what you know we know of his past and is presented in the book, too, is that he is an expert in pharmacology. He, if anybody could advise players on what to do or what not to do, it would be Scott Boras. I would say that he has a very intimate knowledge of how drugs work. We have someone quoted in the book talking about what a good pharmacist he was, how he knew how drugs interacted with the body. He's had a very big interest over the years in HGH as a sort of a youth drug. I'm not saying that Scott is connected A to B with everything, but he certainly is of it if he's not in it. And I would say that sometimes Scott needs to be a little bit more forward in the way that he answers questions about it.
What about the teams that these guys play for? Shouldn't they have been a bit more vigilant? A-Rod wasn't the only player on the Yankees who's been linked to steroids,
mm-hmm.
or the Texas Rangers for that matter.
Right. You know, the Yankees have an interesting history. There certainly is a conga line of players who have passed through the steroid era who have also worn pinstripes over the years. Alex is among those. And I would say, here's what I have a question with the Yankees about. In 2007, maybe they didn't have the smoking gun evidence, certainly, of steroid use, but they certainly should question themselves about signing a guy that age for that length of time. But I would also say that when they signed him that $300 million deal in November of 2007, they added these clauses that are very individualistic for the Yankees. The Yankees, as you know, don't have names on the back of the jerseys. It's all about team. And yet in his contract, in Alex's deal, there's $6 million every time he passes go. That means that every time he passes one of the top four players on the all-time home run list, he gets $6 million. That's basically, to me, saying to Alex, you know what? Whatever you're doing, keep doing what you're doing. So I think in so many ways, the Yankees have enabled a lot of this by really placing an emphasis on the power, on the surreal, on the too good to be true, all in the sake of money.
My guest is Selina Roberts, formerly a columnist for the New York Times, now a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and author of A-Rod, The Many Lies of Alex Rodriguez, which is published by Harper's. You describe Rodriguez's obsession with the game and his physique, but also to the point where he really thinks about the food that he eats, brining his own food, bringing his own food to the stadium, not eating the stuff that's supplied. So I would think it would come as a bit of a surprise that he would use steroids when so much had been written about the fact that steroids had a negative effect ultimately on your body.
But you know what? The reward for it is so great. And for somebody who needs to be the best, who needs to be not just be the best, but be known as the best, the way you get there is you are the scorecard. And the scorecard says the highest paid athlete in the game is the best paid athlete in the game. He gets to the highest paid athlete in the game because of the power, because of his statistics. And if you can plump those up, you can certainly plump up your income. I think the reward outweighed the risk for Alex. Here's a guy who's very in tune to what he puts in his body, yes. He's very much meticulous about what he does. But when you do that and you are very sophisticated about steroid use, and again, I don't buy the amateur hour excuse that he gave. It's a very sophisticated process. You can talk yourself into thinking that you are doing something good for your body because you think you know better than everybody else. I think that's where he was.
Some people have wondered about your sources for this book. So many are anonymous. And Scott Boras, among others, has said that really puts the book under a cloud. Why are there so many anonymous sources? As I understand it right now, at the New York Times, you wouldn't be allowed to do that.
No, I worked at the New York Times, and I would say that every story in the steroid era about Barry Bonds, especially about his drug testing, was written with these words, people close to the situation say. So that's a fallacy. I'm not sure if that's a move to discredit the book or what, but Scott Boras should know better. I've had conversations with Scott Boras in the past, as have many baseball writers, and the first thing that comes out of Scott Boras' mouth is, can we go off the record? So it's pretty disingenuous of him to talk about a cloud when he is of it and in it as far as every leak that is done during trades. When you talk about steroids, when you talk about anything with Scott Boras, it's almost always off the record when he has something to say that's important. So I would say that that's pretty disingenuous on his part, but I would say about the sourcing is this. When the story broke in February, it was based on 7 anonymous sources, 4 about the drug testing, 3 about the tipping of a drug test to Alex in 2004. The information in that story has been irrefutable. It's been solid. It's been credible. The same litmus test that was applied to those sources is applied throughout the book. There are more than 60 people on the record. There are 19 people off the record. And that is about steroid era. And every reporter who's reported on steroids, not the armchair quarterbacks who seem to be talking about it now, but those of us who's actually done the reporting, Mike Schmidt at the New York Times, Mark Fanruwata at the San Francisco Chronicle, all the reporting, the important reporting on steroids has been done anonymously.
Well, and when you're talking about a team sport, it would be considered disloyal to put your name on any accusation, wouldn't it?
It's not only disloyal, it's also dangerous to your future. And here's what players will say, and this has been written about a couple of times. There is that thin blue line in the clubhouse where you don't finger somebody else. We know that the man who's fingered more people than ever Jose Canseco is ostracized. He'll never get a job in Major League Baseball. He'll never be part of the union's plan for anything in the future. He worries about his pension. He worries about everything involved with baseball because he feels like he's been blackballed. Now, players look at that and they say, you know what? I don't want that to be me. When you stick your neck out in baseball, you're not even risking the thought of being called a traitor. They really feel like you're risking the wrath of a union that is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, in sports, in the history of sports, is a union that is very unforgiving to guys who cross the line. And I think that's why, like I said, not just in my reporting, but the reporting in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Washington Post, all throughout the steroid era, you have seen things based on people close to the situation say. That phrase is used over and over and over again, and it's used for a reason. Not to escape accountability for that, but to protect people who really are afraid that if they put their neck out there, it's going to be cut off.
Well, I can understand why the union might want to protect players because of steroids, because so many use them.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't see the union being happy about this other story that you've revealed, that A-Rod tipped batters on the opposing teams about what pitch was coming. So
you know,
that they would return the favor. That is something that does cross the line in baseball, doesn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely one of those things in a clubhouse that is so destructive. I mean, the one thing I've learned since the book has come out is the player's response to that. They feel like it's far more egregious than steroids because steroids are the deal that you make with the devil. You put in what you put in your body, you pay the consequences. Maybe you get rewarded for it. Maybe your deal's bigger than everybody else's. But at the end of the day, you're going to put yourself at risk. When you tip somebody else, and this is what Alex did with the Rangers, actually people have come out since the book came out and they have validated my reporting on this. When you do that, when you tip an opposing player, you are hurting this kid who may be on the mound in the minor leagues, who just got called up. This is his one chance to prove that he belongs, and he gets cracked with a hit or he gets cracked with a home run. His ERA blows up. Maybe he's a short timer and he's out of there. Or another worst case scenario is you extend an inning when you give up a hit to another guy. You extend the inning, somebody get hurt. All those little things that are actually baseball oriented, absolutely to the core of baseball, can happen. Along with, of course, the guy who walks on the bus and looks at you and doesn't think he can trust you anymore because you're the guy that's tipping the other team.
Has this been suggested during his time at the Yankees or just when he was with the Texas Rangers and so unhappy about being on a losing team?
Well, what he was trying to do was get that extra hit for himself. He was basically applying for slump insurance. When you get in a quid pro quo with another player, you're not only tipping him, you're hoping that in a case where you're 0 for 4 and the game's out of hand, he's going to tip you right back. Remember, this wasn't about throwing a game or gambling or anything like that. This was basically about trying to steal an extra hit for your average. And as we know, throughout a whole season, people think, well, one hit's insignificant. Well, it's 2 points to your average. If you get 4 or 5 hits, that's 8 to 10 points. That really does make a difference at the end of the year. So it's not insignificant.
So are people tipping him off as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's a quid pro quo. Basically, Alex expected, and these are from the sources that I talked to, and also has been corroborated by some other reporting today as well from a St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that there was a quid pro quo going on that was very obvious to certain people who were witnessing Alex on a daily basis. These were sources that saw a pattern of behavior where he would give a guy a tip, and then when he was at the plate in this very same blowout game, he would get the tip in return, pick up an extra hit here or there. It wasn't often. It was certainly certain to the situation in a game. It was situational, but it kept happening. And the thing about Alex, he had so much power with the Rangers. He was known as the assistant GM. He had breakfast with Tom Hicks, the owner, every day. He talked to him about player moves. He even talked to Tom Hicks, and Tom Hicks is on the record with this in the book, saying he used to tell me all the time about everybody else who was using steroids, that he was the clean one, that everybody else was doing it. So there certainly was some disingenuous behavior going on with him, with the Rangers. Now, you ask about the Yankees. When he switches to third base, you're not the quarterback of the infield anymore. You don't have that bird's-eye view into the catcher to pick up the signs, and that's what he was doing with the Rangers. So I would say it would be very difficult for him now to be tipping those signs being at third base.
Just one more thing. We began by saying you started this looking into his personal life, and he has been very focused on the game throughout mm-hmm. his career. Is that why his affair with Madonna, if there was an affair,
yeah.
and his embrace of Kabbalah were surprising to so many people?
You know, it was surprising to me in a way, too, because when I started looking at that relationship, I kind of thought, like a lot of people, and it was portrayed in the media as a bit of a publicity stunt, like this can't be real, this is because she's going on tour. Now, from her side of it, it might have been publicity, but from his side of it, let's face it, he changed his whole life for Madonna. He was, and when he met her and started to get to know her at the end of 2007, he was a married man with a child and a child on the way. He basically did a jackknife on that personality, went to be, you know, Madonna's guy, sneaking up the elevator, seeing her, soulmate, all the things that were flying in the tabloids. He fell in love with her. He told his teammates he was in love with her. He told his friends he was in love with her. He really did change his entire life for her. Kabbalah was part of that. Let's face it. Before Madonna, he was a card-carrying Republican. He's on record that he gave Rudy Giuliani money for his presidential campaign, and then he voted for Barack Obama after meeting Madonna. Suddenly he's a Democrat. So Alex, as we know, is a searcher. There's no doubt about that. And I think Madonna played into that, searching for his identity, searching for status, and it was the real deal as far as Alex Rodriguez goes. Now, on her side of it, who knows? You know, she's had some, you know, the line is very long, but it keeps moving with Madonna, so she's been around for a while. But I think Alex, for him, it was a status marker, it was the real deal, and they certainly fell in love enough to change his life for her.
Well, where is he now? He's no longer with Madonna.
Not a romantic version of that relationship. Obviously, I'm told they're still friends, and he still gets advice from her. But I don't think that he can afford to be in that celebrity world as much. My understanding is he's trying to pare down the entourage, which is a good thing, I think, trying to distance himself a little bit from Guy Oseary, who was Madonna's manager. So maybe he's taking the steps to sort of get away from the circus a little bit and get back to baseball.
Well, he has to get back to baseball.
Mm-hmm.
A-Rod, The Many Lives of Alex Rodriguez, is published by Harper. Thank you so much, Selena Roberts, for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.